Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go, then drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to ask for a little bit of support. I mentioned last week the exciting news that I've decided to leave my hospitality industry job to go into podcast editing and production and promoting Sleepy Time Tales properly and treating this whole podcasting thing a little bit more professionally. I'm doing this because in the hospitality business, I haven't spent as much time as I've liked with my family, and cost of living is going up, getting around is going up, and post-pandemic or not even post-pandemic world, I don't feel very safe working sometimes with hundreds or thousands of people in the course of one day. So I've decided to make the big step to go into something else, working from home. And while I have a bit of a nest egg and I'm not in a desperate situation, now is a good time for any listeners so inclined to help out by signing up to the Patreon, use the Sleep Phone referral link, buy some merch. I'm actually busy in the process of putting up some new designs on TeePublic in the next few days as you listen to this. Or just throw a little bit of money in the tip jar. All of these are up on the Sleepy Time Tales website, which also is a bit of a mess at the moment because I'm moving hosts. Again, I'm professionalizing everything, so I'm moving to a more reliable service there. As you listen to this now, it should be all up and running and in a good state. Otherwise, everything is also in the show notes and you can take a look from there. And other than just throwing money at my way, if you or someone you know is wanting to start a podcast or runs one and would like to hand off the technical side, you can give me a shout. Pop me a line at dave@bradfoxaudio.com and I can consult with you to see what your needs are and see if we can do some business. And of course, while money is handy, it also helps simply to spread the word. So if you enjoy Sleepy Time Tales, there's someone you know who you think will find it useful, or you think someone might need some podcast editing or production services, just let them know and send them our way. And I'm going to leave it there, because this has gone on a little bit long. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? What is this strange thing, this strange idea, this podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of the 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Time Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night, or sometimes background noise or simply company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. The primary idea is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to give you just enough focus not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep. The second way is something a little bit different. Maybe some people just need background noise, some kind of white noise or sound of the ocean, sound of the rain, sound of the wind in the trees, or the sound of some boring dude just droning on in the background. It's important, though, as you listen, that you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow the sleep to come for you when you're ready. Now, obviously, I'm hoping that all goes well and you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode. But it's important you don't feel pressurized. It will probably take a few nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Maybe one episode isn't long enough. Or maybe just simply the idea of this is just a little bit strange. Or maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep. Maybe your problem is waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend in that case, because it's what works for me, is to let the podcast run all night. Download a whole bunch of episodes into your podcatcher of choice, put them in a playlist, and then as you go to sleep, let them go. So that whenever time you wake up at night, if you find yourself in the dark, not quite sure that you're awake or you're asleep, just pop those earbuds back in and drift off again. You can even do the same sort of thing if you find yourself waking up before the alarm. I've had the same alarm for so long that that's actually my tendency, so it's a feeling I know quite well. And if you wake up 30 minutes or 60 minutes before the alarm, you can use sleepy time tails to go back to sleep again. And it may sound strange, what good is another 30 minutes of sleep? But I can tell you now, I'm not sure what it is, but there's something about allowing yourself the pure deep relaxation right before the alarm that's satisfying on a whole new level. But as you listen, it's important you relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this may seem strange to you, so give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. We return once again to Old Glass and How to Collect It by J. Sidney Lewis. Chapter 3. 18th Century Glass. The 18th century is the golden age of the collector of English glass. At the beginning of the century, glass manufacture was already a flourishing industry. Vessels of all kinds for ornament, keepsakes, and for domestic use were being produced in great quantities, and there was a strong and growing competition between the native craftsmen and the glass workers of Venice, Bohemia, Germany, and the Low Countries. A competition which, thanks to the superiority of the new English flint glass, was steadily trending in favor of the English product. As a result, the collector is at once on firmer ground. His knowledge of earlier periods had been gleaned haphazard from drawings, paintings, tapestries, mosaics, and historical documents, with only here and there a specimen and that of dubious authenticity to guide him. From this time, he is able to observe at first hand, compare, classify, note differences, excellences, and defects. There is no longer any lack of material, either of the finer sort suitable for the tables of the great and wealthy, or of the coarser kind, whose only merit was utility. With the growing profusion, however, came a veritable confusion of types, which renders any attempt at classification a matter of very considerable difficulty. To a great extent, this arose from the toping habits of our forefathers, in perhaps the most convivial period of our history. There was a vast improvement in social conditions and amenities, and the variety of glasses that sprang into existence affords ample testimony to this, as well as to the variety of drinks in favour and to the ingenuity of the time, in devising toasts and sentiments, no less than to the skill of the English craftsmen and the individuality of the various makers. At the beginning of the century, however, the use of different glasses for different kinds of wine had not yet arisen. A bowl of water was placed on the table, in which the drinkers rinsed their glasses when a new vintage made its appearance. Subsequently, each guest had a special bowl for this purpose. These bowls are exceedingly rare and are generally described as wine coolers. Their modern equivalent is the finger bowl. There was naturally a vast difference between the glass of the early part of the century and that of the later part. Speaking very broadly, the order of progress was as follows. 1. Heavy glass with baluster stems. 2. Lighter glass with air-twisted stems. 3. Drawn stems. 4. Opaque twisted stems. And 5. Cut glass. Many of these glasses are still in existence, and it is even possible for an amateur collector to acquire an occasional specimen. This early 18th century glass is of remarkable quality, both as regards form and luster. It is true that it is less perfect in shape and texture than the products of today, but it is superior in artistic merit, in originality of design and softness of outline. The lack of perfect symmetry is one of its charms, as is the case of old lace, which, so far as absolute and meticulous perfection of detail is concerned, is often far behind the modern machine-made product. But what it lacks in symmetry and precision is more than compensated by artistic feeling. Mr. Hartshorne, in his monumental work on Old English Glasses, a work to which the present writer and every other writer on the subject must acknowledge a vast indebtedness, makes an exhaustive classification of the various types of 18th century glasses. To his order, one is bound closely to conform, although it is far from the province of the present work to attempt to deal exhaustively with the various types he so fully and admirably describes. The earliest examples have funnel-shaped bowls with tall stems. These are of great variety of shape. Some are quite plain, others are twisted, others ribbed. Some, again, are baluster-shaped, i.e. formed after the pattern of the columns of a balustrade. Many have a knob or button in the middle. Others are ornamented with twisted lines, either hollow or filled with glass of different colors, interwoven in spirals, twists, networks and plates in all kinds of ingenious ways. Of course, all these things being distinctive are imitable, and here the peril of the collector begins. The expert is rarely deceived as to whether any specimen is genuine old glass, but so pervasive and so perfect are the imitations that exist, and so plausible the conditions under which they are found, that it behoves the amateur to use the extremest caution. I propose to deal at some length with some of the more obvious and frequent frauds and fakes in a subsequent chapter. But for the moment it may be said that the best test of genuineness is neither shape nor any particular design, for those can be closely imitated, but the color. There is a curious tint in old glass, which the newer never quite achieves. That would-be small collector will be well advised if, before riding his hobby, he goes through a brief course of eye training under the guidance of an expert, until he gets the exact tone of the old glass firmly impressed upon his memory. As an additional factor, it should always be borne in mind that the old glass is invariably heavier than its modern imitation. It It will be desirable at this point to describe in brief detail the more important of the types of 18th century glass enumerated on page 59. Glasses with incised and ribbon-twisted stems. The incised or ribbon-twisted stemmed glass is usually about 6 inches high, with generally a flanged or outward curved top and a comparatively slender stem. A series of ribs was impressed by a mold on the stem, whilst yet plastic. The stem was fixed to its bowl, heated till soft, and then gently twisted, and at the same time stretched. The result was a twist, produced in exactly the same way as in a stick of candy, close at the top and gradually loosening towards the bottom. Near the foot, by the way, the spiral generally disappears entirely as the effect of the heating process, necessary when the foot was joined to the stem. The bowl was almost invariably wasted. That is, its sides were bent inwards. The foot was folded, and there was a characteristic lessening in the diameter of the stem as it neared the bottom, which the puller of toffee will readily understand. Air-twisted stems. The air twist probably began with a tear. The tear of the glass blower is a bubble of air blown into the center of a mass of molten glass, possibly at first by accident and afterwards by design, as a form of ornamentation. When the stem was drawn out, the bubble elongated into a tube, and when the stem was twisted, the tube acquired a spiral shape. Now, as the tube was filled with air, which had a different refractive capacity to the glass which surrounded it, the effect of the light falling upon it was to produce a kind of silvery radiance, like that of quicksilver. The phenomenon is familiar to anyone who has ever plunged a substance like wool, which contains air bubbles entangled among its meshes under water. The bubbles are transformed into drops like quicksilver. So with the tear in the tube drawn from it and the air-twisted stem. Naturally, the decorative potentialities of this phenomenon were speedily recognized and utilized, and the air-twisted stems are among the most characteristic and most beautiful features of all Old English glasses. The bowls were usually of the same general shape as those with incised and ribbon-twisted stems. The earlier varieties are wasted. The later ones frequently assume the bell shape. They are often engraved. The early ones are the Tudor rose with its 5 petals, while the later ones affect the Stuart variety with 6 petals. The earliest stems have necks and collars. There was considerable difficulty in joining the air-twisted stem onto the bowl without damaging the twist. Later varieties have necks only. The collars are sometimes knobbed, i.e. have knobs attached, and the stems themselves are shouldered. I have dealt at some length with the air-twisted stems, since this is a characteristic English variety, and one to which the brilliant English flint glass was especially adapted. Consequently, the type persisted for a considerable period. The later varieties, however, achieved some little distinction by the adoption of the bell-shaped bowl. Drawn stems. I have already suggested that the fusion of the air-twisted stem, in order to join it to the bowl, not unfrequently resulted in damage to the twist. It was an obvious solution of the difficulty to draw the stem out from the surplus molten metal at the base of the bowl. If, previously, a series of air bubbles was introduced into this mass, each in the process of drawing out became elongated into a tube, and we have the possibility, by planting tears in effective positions, and then judiciously twisting the drawn stem, whilst still plastic, of producing an infinity of pleasing patterns. Thus, a number of small tears close together produced a spiral like a yarn or silk. Or a central tear might be blown and side ones twisted around in encircling spirals. Baluster-stemmed glasses. The baluster stem is a reproduction of a moulded pillar. It is by no means peculiar to 18th century glasses. Indeed, it formed the most invariable means of support for the glasses of Carolingian times. The early baluster stems are, to an eye accustomed to the latter modern glass, extremely heavy and clumsy in appearance. And with the development of taste and skill, they were speedily supplanted by the slenderer and more graceful, drawn and air-twisted stems. But the effect of the baluster moulding was soon pressed into the service of this more dainty ware, the baluster becoming more slender and symmetrical, sometimes indeed being modified into a slight swelling, either gradual or abrupt, or a single ring around the stem. The bowls of this period were almost invariably funnel-shaped, and were often engraved, the appropriate figure of the vine leaf appearing for the first time in the history of English glass. The feet are almost always of the folded variety. Occasionally in the later specimens, however, the feet are domed. Opaque twisted stems. The opaque twisted stem made its appearance about the middle of the century. In this case, rods of opaque white or coloured glass were alternated with rods of clear glass around the circumference of a circular mould, care being taken to preserve proper regularity. They were then heated and molten clear glass poured into the central hollow, filling up the interstices between the rods, binding the whole when cooled into a solid rod, with a clear centre surrounded by a particoloured circumference. The mass, being softened by heating, was then drawn out into slenderer rods and twisted into spirals. The ease of the process accounts for the infinite variety of patterns in existence. Flat bars could be used, giving tape-like spiral bands, and the rods could be of various sizes and colors. Many specimens came over from Holland and from the north of France, generally of inferior quality. Inferiority being displayed in the character of the stem and the poorness of the metal. The simplicity of the manufacture has also given rise to hosts of modern imitations, largely from the continent. In a great number of these, the spirals turn to the left, which has given rise to an idea that all glasses with right-hand opaque spiral stems are modern imitations, which is by no means the case. All such specimens, however, are sufficiently suspect to demand careful scrutiny, and the amateur, before purchasing a right-handed, spiral, opaque, twisted glass, will do well to submit it to the judgment of an expert. Points to be considered are the color of the metal, the perfection of the twist, its opacity, and the character of the foot. The color and weight of the glass are probably the best criteria. The forgeries are generally light, and the beautiful mellow tone of the real old English glass is replaced by cold white tint, or even a tinge of green. The twist is often more translucent than in the genuine pieces, and is frequently imperfectly produced, becoming looser as it descends, the loosening being particularly pronounced just before its junction with the foot. The appearance of the foot is of the utmost value. Before the 19th century, the scar, where the piece after manufacture was broken away from the pontil, was invariably left rough instead of being ground down. The foot in the genuine glasses is never flat. there being always a slight slope downwards towards the edge. In the imitations too, it is apt to be less in diameter compared with the bowl than in the genuine specimens, while there is frequently an absence of ring. This last fact, however, must not be unduly emphasized, since many undoubtedly authentic specimens of this period, including some of the finest, share the defect. Another test is to note the edge of the bowl, whether it is well rounded off or whether it has been left hard and sharp. Many of these glasses are engraved with flowers. The rose is so frequent as to have given its name to a special type, the rose glasses. The rose has often a bud or two, and a butterfly is frequently represented as hovering over the flower. In later specimens, the butterfly degenerates into a moth, and finally vanishes altogether. Other flowers engraved on the glasses of the same type and period were the Rose of Sharon and the St. John's Wort. Rose glasses, with blue and white twisted stems, are in all probability almost exclusively of English manufacture, and are among the most valuable of the opaque twisted type. The foreign importations of the period were numerous, but, apart from certain patterns of twist, which may be considered exclusively English, the twisting of the Low Countries was distinctly inferior. One type is characteristic of the foreign product. This has a central tube of thin white lines, surrounded by spiral twists. Where the stem is of the baluster type, this central tube more or less follows the contour of the stem. Straight-sided glasses. The term straight-sided may be used to designate a whole series of glasses, of which the bowls are of the shape of a truncated cone, the narrow end being, of course, downward. In process of time, the sharpness of the section at the bottom was more and more rounded, until it attained the shape of the OG curve. The earliest of the straight-sided glasses had bulbed stems, with a shoulder and knob. The better sorts of tavern and household glasses were of this type, the larger specimens being used for wine and punch, and the smaller for cordials and strong waters. Two points are worthy of notice. The folded foot was practically invariable, and the diameter of the foot was always substantially greater than that of the bowl, thus ensuring a sound support. The bowls themselves were at first plain. About the middle of the century, however, we find them decorated with conventional flowers and vine leaves, etc., which were gradually replaced by closer and more artistic representations of such natural objects as roses, as a matter of course, lilies of the valley, tulips, and sprays of honeysuckle. Amongst these, however, certain conventional designs held their place. For example, wild roses, St. John's wort, and other blossoms with large seeded centres, which seem to have impressed themselves strongly upon the imagination of the artists to whom the decoration was entrusted. The bowls were, in very rare instances, fluted. The pieces were made in three parts: bowl, stem, and foot. The stem being sometimes plain, often air-twisted, and sometimes opaque-twisted. The straight-sided bowl was never popular amongst continental glass workers, so that the probability is that any specimen found is of English manufacture. In examples of foreign manufacture too, the bowl was generally rounded at the base, and the stems were often coloured or opaque-twisted. Other characteristics by which these may be identified are their comparative lightness of weight, their fragility, their coarse lavishness of decoration, their narrow bases, while the fluting of the stems is often unduly close, and the bowls have wide, flat flutes. OG glasses. The straight-sided glass is changed by easy degrees into the well-known OG shape, the lines of the bowl being gradually merged into those of the stem. It may be safely asserted that the majority of OG-shaped glasses are of English manufacture. The majority have opaque twisted stems. Sometimes blue lines replace the opaque white. It is thought that Bristol was the chief place of manufacture, since most of the finds have been in the west of England. The earliest of them have unfolded feet, inserted air-twisted stems, and naturally, since the object of the designer was to preserve the OG line, no shoulders. Many of them were of considerable dimension, a possible result of drinking bumpers. A great number of the memorial glasses, treated off in a separate chapter, were of this type. The scheme of decoration followed much the same lines as that of the straight-sided glass, but a greater proportion were plain. Possibly the curves towards the bottom of the bowl made the engraver's task more difficult. In later specimens, sprigs of laurel and festoons of various conventional types are to be found. In the Bristol glasses, the bowls were sometimes fluted, and a double OG curve was employed. The upper part only being decorated, generally with fine leaves and bunches of grapes. The steps were bowled or knobbed, and the feet were folded. Champagne glasses. There is, of course, no real reason why one kind of wine should be drunk from a glass of special shape and another from a totally different one. But once glass drinking vessels had become the vogue, this habit of specializing in the shape and size of glasses speedily became the fashion, and crystallized into a custom which persists even to this day in our port, sherry, champagne, claret, and liqueur glasses. In the beginning, there was a far greater diversity, for England in the 18th century was famous for the number and potency of its beverages. And speaking generally, each had its appropriate glass. Frequently, of course, there was little diversity of shape, the difference being in the nature of the ornamentation, which in a number of cases was specially devised to indicate the purpose of the glass. Thus, an ale glass would be adorned with ears of barley or bunches of hops, a wine glass with fine leaves or bunches of grapes, a cider glass with sprays of apple blossom, and so forth. Champagne was, in the 18th century, a wine of comparatively recent introduction, and was drunk only by the rich and great. Probably at first no special glasses were used for it. The more elegant of those already in existence, presumably bell-shaped and air-stemmed, being pressed into the service. But about 1730 special glasses were made, with wide shallow bowls of the double OG variety, and a baluster. They had knobbed or double-knobbed stems and domed feet. Sometimes, as might be anticipated, an air or an opaque twisted stem was employed, while the shape of the bowl varied towards the bell shape, in that it became hemispherical. Subsequently, the bowl became elongated into a narrow cone, the stems exemplifying the various patterns of the day: baluster, knob, double knobbed, air twisted, opaque twisted, and drawn. In the later examples, the elongation was so pronounced that the glasses approximated to the familiar flute shape. In these, the stem is often faceted, the facets sometimes extending some considerable distance up the glass. The modern champagne glass, with a wide saucer-like bowl and a hollow stem, seems to be a sort of combination of the two. The wine being a rarity, the glasses are scarce, and the collector, who unearths a genuine specimen of an early 18th century champagne glass, may esteem himself fortunate. The shallow glasses were so little known that 100 years later, in 1832, Disraeli, writing to his sister, remarks, "We drank champagne out of a saucer of glass mounted on a pedestal of cut glass," so that the form was evidently a novelty, at least to him. Sweetmeat glasses. Closely allied to the shallow champagne glasses were the sweetmeat glasses. The latter are, however, much solider, while their edges are crinkled and undulated and van dyked into various patterns. The feet are generally domed, sometimes plain, and at other times ribbed or ornamented with knobs. The bowls are generally either of the double OG type or bell-shaped with a lip. They are often ribbed in the earlier varieties and cut in the later ones. The glasses were made in sets which stood upon a glass pedestal or centerpiece made to a similar pattern. They had a flat, tray-like top with a raised rim. One interesting feature is that each set consisted of a number of small glasses and one large one, known as a captain or master glass, which was not necessarily of the same pattern as the smaller ones. The captain had generally an abnormally small foot, so that it might not unduly encroach upon the standing space. Ale and beer glasses. There is no particular difference between the tall champagne glass and the ale glass. Possibly the ale glass was modelled upon the flute-shaped champagne glass, or possibly the shapes were used indiscriminately for both beverages. The finer and more elegant specimens for the champagne, and the heavier and more substantial ones for the humbler ale. That they were so used is sufficiently indicated by the fact that many specimens have been discovered, which are engraved with festoons or bunches of hops and ears of barley. The earlier specimens, however, were plain. It may be useful to point out that the form of the stem affords some indication of the relative age of the piece, the chronological order being roughly as follows. 1. Wasted bowls with plain stems and folded feet. 2. Air-twisted stems, shouldered, collared, and knobbed. 3. Plain-drawn stems. 4. Opaque twisted stems. The glasses diminish in height as the century progresses. Other kinds of glasses. It is customary to include in the classification of 18th century glasses those used for cider and perry, mum, mead, and syllabub. It is difficult to prove that any particular kind of glass was set apart for the consumption of these liquors. Cider, however, was produced in large quantities, and glasses were possibly made specially for it. Certain specimens exist and are recognized by their being engraved with apple blossom, apple trees, etc., whilst one, mentioned in the chapter on memorial glasses, is inscribed with the motto "No Excess." Speaking generally, it may be asserted that ordinary cider was probably drunk from earthenware mugs, after the fashion of the beer mugs of today, whilst the strong cider was consumed from wine glasses. No glass has so far been distinctively associated with perry. Mum was a somewhat awesome decoction, in which the principal ingredient was malted wheat, to which was added a little oats or bean meal, the brew being flavored with various pungent and aromatic herbs, and the inner bark and tips of the fir tree. It is presumed to have been drunk from glasses of the ale champagne type, but among the common folk, it is probable mugs were proffered. The clamorous crowd is hushed with mugs of mum, till all turned equal, send a general hum. Pope. Mead, or meath, was a drink, the basis of which was honey. This, being dissolved in boiling water, was flavored with spices and ground malt added, and the whole left to ferment. It was drunk from bowl-shaped glasses, or else from glasses of the low tumbler top. If carefully made, it would keep for a long time, and from the number of references to it which appear in literature, it was evidently a favorite drink, particularly among the lower classes. Ben Jonson, in his The Devil is an Ass, written in 1616, remarks, "Carmen, either got into the yellow starch, and chimney sweepers to their tobacco and strong waters, hum, Mitha Nobani." Syllabub was a mixture of wine, ale, or cider, with cream or milk, and flavored with lemon or rose water. The whipped syllabubs were beaten into a froth before drinking. They were often made with milk drawn fresh from the cow, the drinkers repairing to the dairy for the purpose. The ale berries, caudals, and possets in each one, and syllabubs made at the milking pail. Although they be many, bear come not in any, but all are composed of the pot of good ale. Syllabub glasses, as far as there were special glasses used, were of deep cut or tumbler shape, the brim flaring outward. And on that note, I think I'm going to call it a good night. If you'd like to pick up where we're leaving off, as always, you can find the original on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night and sweet dreams.